You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Michael Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. My guest today is Tama Janowitz, the author most recently of the Male Crossdresser Support Group, author as well of Slaves of New York, American Dad, and A Cannibal in Manhattan. I thought I'd begin by asking you about your favorite comic writers.
Well, that's off the top of my head, something I'm going to instantly blank out on, but I suppose Mark Twain is one of my favorites, and a lot of Dickens. Joyce Carey, The Horse's Mouth was one of my favorite books, but now I'm just drawing a blank.
I had the feeling that you liked Evelyn Waugh.
I do. I mean, particularly the later books when they're a little less...
brittle?
Yeah.
Because of the characters who appear in Waugh. I was thinking really of The First Decline and Fall. These strange doodlebugs appear and start immediately to spill their life stories at a moment's notice onto the hero there, and that seems to be one of your deftest comic ploys, the person who can't resist disburdening him or herself of everything within a moment's notice.
Yes, thanks.
Is that a characteristic? I haven't been in New York in a long time. Do people like to tell about themselves within the first 20 seconds of their introduction?
Well, I think people give away far more than they suspect or know that they're deliberately saying. I mean, I think what a book can do is throw you into somebody else's head in a way that nothing else can. I mean, movies, you're once removed and you're watching somebody's adventures. And to me, a book, when you pick it up and somebody's telling you, hey, this is what it's like to be me, at least as the reader, I have that moment where I can find out what it's like to be another human being.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I'm thinking more of the kind of, and I guess I can't ask you how do you do it, because it's one of the mysteries that you never know, but that wild improvisatory sense of people inventing themselves on the spur of the moment, usually in the form of mammoth jeremiads, you know, with lists of woes and complaints that seem to be, you know, your stock in trade as a comic writer.
Well, it is true that living in New York, there's too many people and they're all crowded up together in too small a space and everything's breaking down and crumbling, and there's certainly a lot of lunatics. I mean, people that are crazy and genuinely mentally ill. And to walk down the street, they do all seem to be shouting out their life stories at you. And if they're not shouting them out to you, they're shouting them out so loudly to whoever they're with that you can't help but hear it anyway.
Do you have any people that you try your material out on?
I give it to my mom to read, and my husband, and my agent, my editors. But, you know, I mean, what you were saying, am I listening to what people are saying? I don't feel that I'm that good an observer. I mean, a lot of times as a writer, I pull the test on myself, what was the person wearing? Or somebody else will say to me, did you see what she was wearing? Or did you see, you know, his body or whatever? And I realize I haven't seen it. I must not be that much of an observer. But the other one, the other Tama who's sitting at the typewriter, she must be the one who's the observer because she pulls all this stuff out that I don't know where it came from.
I don't know about observer, but you seem to be an absolutely spectacular mimic.
Yes, well, thanks. I mean, but as I say, there's somebody else at that typewriter because most of the time I'm so terrified to be around other human beings that I can't pay them that much attention anyway.
Your mom is a poet, yes?
Yes, my mother's a professor at Cornell, and she's always been hugely supportive of me. Supportive in the sense, not that she said, now you're a great genius, you're going to, you know, you'll be rich and famous. She was supportive of me in saying, look, if this is what you want to do with your life, then do it, and you may not ever get published, and you may not make any money, but I think you should do what you want to in life. And she couldn't offer me financial assistance, but she always said, if it gets too tough and you run out of money, you can come and live in my extra bedroom. And the thing is, I think that I was lucky in that for most people and most women, they don't have that support from their family. And I think their people are told, go get a job. Look, we'll put you through law school. Then you're on your own. Go get married. Have kids. But there's not really much support if you want to branch off the mainstream path.
Some writers only gradually discover that they're funny. And I think in the case, for instance, of Philip Roth, there are two or three naturalistic books of good short stories, but nothing that would anticipate his wildness. Did you know that from the beginning as a writer?
Well, I was writing books for me and for my mother, and we had the same sense of humor, and we liked the same books. And I knew that if my mother liked what I was doing, at least I had an audience of one person. Now, the truth is that we both have a sort of quirky, weird, offbeat sense of humor, and it's usually somebody that's being harassed in a sort of Kafkaesque sense. And I wasn't deliberately trying to be funny or strange, but I was trying to be honest about my feelings, and when my mother said that I was honest, I felt that I had done what I intended.
You know, because from the very first, when the pieces appeared in The New Yorker, I was so taken with them. I really loved their freshness and their enthusiasm. And then, you know, and I liked you in kind of the way I liked Deborah Eisenberg. There was a, you know, kind of great freshness and intensity and strangeness to the stories. And then it was as if people turned on you, and I never really understood why. You know, it didn't really make sense to me. It wasn't as if the writing changed. It seemed something else entirely. Do you have anything to say about that?
No, just really that I felt it, too, and it's sort of been devastating. I mean, because the sort of attacks on me were very extreme, and the articles about what a bad person I was and how terrible I was were so sort of overboard, and the reviews too. And I thought, well, wait a minute, I didn't kill anybody, and I haven't, you know, abused a child or anything, and I'm trying to write and to find an audience that possibly has my sense of humor and taste so I can get another book published in a time when publishing is very tricky and they don't have much money for it, and also to make enough money to write another book. So I think I got a lot of attention in that. They didn't realize it wasn't great attention. It was just a lot of it.
Well, it was sort of funny because I tend to agree about this book, The Male Crossdresser Support Group, that was just published by Crown.
Thank you.
That with Robert Plunkett, who loved it in the New York Times Book Review. And I guess I'm surprised because I have the feeling, and I've said this a bunch, people don't, it's as if someone has a gift for comedy, they, you know, round and say, yes, but she's heartless. If someone has a gift for feeling, they round up and say, yes, but he's, you know, self-absorbed. Look at Harold Brodkey. And I feel as if writers are now attacked rather than cherished for the center of their gift. And I have the feeling that this has something to do with the fact that life has made it necessary for people only to praise the ordinary.
Well, half the time when I read reviews, they seem to be praising something that is so badly written, and then they pull a bit from this novel or book and show you how fantastic the writing is, and it is the purplest prose in the world. It is the most overwritten thing. And I think, wait a minute, this is what they're telling readers is good writing, but this is not an example of good writing. Now, whether the book is good or bad, that's another story, but the bits that they pull out are so often the corniest, most overwritten stuff, and you'd think, hey, if you looked at a review from 70 years ago, then you'd say, this is purple prose and how much more sophisticated we've become now. But in fact, they're still touting the same garbage as being good.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, it's sort of, you know, it's sort of cyclical, it seems to me. This is just, we're in a recycled Hemingway and Fitzgerald and Sherwood Anderson phase. And I guess I came to consciousness during a more crazy and Baroque kind of writing phase, which I prefer. You know, I am more given to sort of spectacular displays of wit and cruelty than I am toward, you know, sodden, small-minded, intimate monosyllabic exchanges of perceptiveness, you know?
Well, I think most of the time I'd rather read nonfiction because I feel like at least I'm, even if it's badly written, learning about somebody's life or a place or something that happened. And so when I do turn to fiction, it is a lot of the time writing that grabs you and says, here I am and this is me, and you're not going to think this is fiction because it sounds so close to the author's own voice and life.
Your humor is often very camp, and camp carries with it a kind of sexual connotation. And one of the pleasures of this book is the sexual spectrum of the writing. It seems as if there's no stone unturned here. Does that involve different styles as a writer? Are you a transvestite?
I feel being female is to begin with like being a drag queen, and the whole premise is to put on lipstick and then you have long hair, and then there's certain clothing, and it's already like I'm in drag. And I mean, I'm not sure, we're living in times where the whole political campaign seems to be geared to the American family and normal sexuality, and there, as if there's a normal and an abnormal instead of just different sexes and different things people want to do. And there's so much insistence on nuclear American family, the mother, the father, the children, and this stands for America, when in fact this was a country of all different kinds of people from all different backgrounds, and they all came over here in the beginning to escape religious persecution, and they didn't fit in to begin with. And the idea that we can dictate to people what a standard is, and that if you don't fit into the standard, boy, you're abnormal and crazy and you're not in our country.
It's sort of funny because sometimes I feel, I guess this is one of the pleasures of the books and the stories, sometimes I feel like the narrator aligns herself with the crazies all around her, and at the same time she seems to take great care to distinguish herself from them. Where do you stand?
I mean, I don't know. I think I'm somewhat crazy, but then I don't think anybody isn't. And also, I can't remember what I was going to say. I mean, so I'm somewhat crazy, big deal. I was thinking when you were saying that my favorite scene in the book was where Pamela is in disguise as a man and she picks up another man who thinks she's a man, and then they go home and they're in bed together, and nothing's been consummated. She picks up a Russian, and so nothing's been consummated, and the guy gets out of the bed to turn off the light or to turn on the light, and he steps on the dog who starts yelping and bites him in the ankle. When he turns on the light, he sees that Pamela isn't a man, she's a woman, and then he says to her, "You're really sick." And I don't know why. I mean, I just like that. I feel that I said what I had to say there.
There's a lot of Shakespeare floating around in this book.
Well, that would be nice.
partially the transvestite, you know, the woman disguising as a man in order to accomplish a mission, but also the presence of a severed head that goes floating through the book as in Measure for Measure. It seems to be sort of like a Shakespearean romance.
I mean, plot-wise, I believe there's nothing left that can be done, and Aristotle summed up the 36 different plots, and since then, anybody who's been writing for theater or books has just simply scrambled the different bits and pieces together. What is left to be done is to tell something about what it's like to be alive today, right now, in my own, or anybody's own particular way, their own vision of the world. Books are the only thing that can put you into somebody else's head, and right now, the end of the 20th century, people's manners, morals, ways of living, behavior, all that is changing so fast that people are sort of staggering around, not really knowing what's acceptable, how to behave, how to live their life. And I'm interested in exploring that on the page.
Well, it's a fascinating thing. You comment several times in the book that the characters are basing their behavior on things they believe themselves to have learned or heard about in the 50s, and that these behavioral codes don't have anything to do with their present lives. And at the same time, they're learning their behaviors from television programs. How does one develop a sense of reality as it's lived?
I'm not sure that there is any reality. I mean, it's true what you're saying. The 50s, to me, are the last period in American history where there were certain clearly delineated patterns of behavior. And in a way, the more rules that there are, the easier it is to live life. And if you were born in the Victorian era and your parents arranged a marriage and everything was set up for you and you knew how to behave and do the waltz and this dance, I mean, it's easier to live life when there's a whole set of rules and standards. And if you choose to break one, then you know exactly what you're doing. But now, if you choose to break a rule, you don't even know that you've broken it. I mean, women of my mother's generation, there were no careers for women. Even if you had graduate degree in economics, the most you could hope for was some secretarial position. And the one thing women could do was to get married and have kids, and that was the way they could move out of their parents' house. And as far as men went, certainly homosexuality was completely taboo, and if they wanted to have sex, they had to get married, because women didn't have sex unless you married. It wasn't what nice women did, and there was no birth control anyway, and illegitimate children were a real stigma. Anyway, all that's changed now, and women are supposed to have careers and have kids, and they're busy competing with each other for the available men and for the jobs, and there's no support system or community or camaraderie. And men, in a way, don't have to be so backstabbing. They have power. They're used to having power. They don't need to crush somebody with less power, but something didn't work out quite right there either, because I don't know. There's no end to that sentence. That's where it ended.
The male cross-dresser support group finds the heroine, Pamela Trowell, by the end attempting to find a child who has attached itself to her and toward whom, despite healthy doses of disgust and suspicion, she begins to feel a certain tenderness, probably the closest relation in the book. Did you feel, you know, this is a plot from, you know, The Ransom of Red Chief on, and probably before, you know, and very common in movies, Little Miss Marker and the rest. Did you feel nervous handling the orphan foster child material?
No, I honestly write in a sort of stupor or trance. And at the time, what happened to me was I was struggling with this book, and I went to the local pizza parlor, and there was this, just like the scene in the book, there was this huge obese woman, and she was eating fried chicken, and she was surrounded by six or eight little kids, and she had bought fried chicken from some other place and taken it to the pizza parlor. And, you know, she wasn't giving these kids anything to eat, and everybody was getting more and more upset, and finally the guy came over and he said to her, "Lady, you leave now. No eat fried chicken in the pizza parlor." And she actually seemed quite violent, and she seemed like she was crazy, and so she left with all the little kids, and it seemed to me that I didn't know what I should do in that situation, and that we're faced with these moral choices that we're not prepared for, or dilemmas that we don't know. I mean, we know what to do if somebody falls over with a heart attack, then you loosen their tie and you call the police, but the real things that arise in life are things that you're not prepared for. You don't know what to do in that situation. And I mean, as that was the human part of me, and it was too late and they were all gone, and, you know, she seemed violent and crazy, and what can you do? There's no money for social services in New York. But the writer part of me thought, what if I gave that little kid a piece of pizza, and then, you know, what if he followed me home and hung out inside the door, and then I had to invite him in and I couldn't get rid of him, and that's the writer part of me that just looks at a paper bag lying by the side of the road and instantly assumes that inside that paper bag is a decapitated head. I, you know, always, in any possible situation, I take it to the extreme.
You know, it's funny because I've recently come to think that it's not that people have no one to talk to, but it does seem to me that people don't know who to address certain things to. Last time I was in New York, I was in the 42nd Street Library, being a bookworm, where else would I go? And a woman was putting money into the Xerox machine, and every time the light would click on, she would talk to it as if it were a telephone. And she said, "You killed the Kennedys, and then you killed Martin Luther King." And then the light would click off, and she'd stop, and she'd put another quarter in, and she'd continue the conversation. "And I'm not going to let you get away with it. You can't kill anyone else." And the light
really?
Would click off
again.
Really? So it
was that again. Xerox machine that did it?
Yeah, as far as she was concerned, you know, the Xerox, and I guess what it represented. And I thought, well, who do you tell these things to? It seems to me that especially in cities, Americans are full of suspicions about who killed who or why things are going on the way they are. And I guess a Xerox machine is as good as a fortune cookie or a psychotherapist.
Well, and cheaper. I mean, I feel that you're right, and a lot of conversation between human beings is spent in one sort of getting the other one to confide, and then you finally feel that you trust the other person enough to say, well, so-and-so was so horrible to me at this party, and as soon as you say that, then they turn to you and say, well, I think so-and-so was very nice. And you know instantly that everything that they've convinced you to confide in them is going to be betrayed behind your back. And what kind of system is this where the whole place is geared up to, you know, how many people can you screw out of how much?
Well, is that, by the way, true? I'm personally terrified because I'm going to be going back there soon. And when I came to your description of the way in which people are graded in New York, and that if you come from good family, this gives you a basic 75 points to begin with, but everything else is going to have to be worked for. Is that true?
Well, I mean, I don't know if it's true. This is my paranoid vision of New York. And, of course, things may be the same in the rest of the country or different or slightly more disguised. But I mean, what can I tell you? It is my vision of the world, which is paranoid and full of cynicism. But, I mean, yes. Yes, to answer your question, yes. I mean, I've seen people and after knowing them off and on for 10 years casually and in distant situations, and one minute they're throwing parties in nightclubs and whooping it up with boys all night and taking drugs, and then you see them a year later and they act, they have a different job and a different position, and they say, I would never associate with drag queens, and act as if that world is so removed and so beneath them. But I saw them 2 years ago hanging out in this world, which is now so beneath contempt, and they've risen so far above it that they deny all participation.
Yes, I know. It's very funny. The very people who one sees most desperately trying to meet actors here in Los Angeles are likely to be the ones who say, usually with some amount of unhappiness, you just can't be friends with actors.
I mean, I don't think it's different here either. I mean, something about actors and actresses, and they're puffed up in the press. They're like Roman gods and goddesses. What's going on here? Most of them can't act at all. I mean, they're just large faces up on these screens mouthing terrible, boring words. But for some reason, this is the only modern thing we have to pray to.
What has it replaced?
Well, I suppose it replaced Mars and before that, Athena and Zeus and...
Uh-huh. Are there...
But instead of them gods and goddesses granting our wishes, we just hope to meet a movie star and then we can say, yes, I was with Jack last night. And I don't get where this raises your status either, because so much of conversations, at least in New York, are about people saying who they were with recently. Now, am I going to like you more? Is it going to make some... I mean, I don't understand what they're...
Oh, it's just insecurity speaking, usually. Someone feeling that the self is so unbalanced and unworthwhile that only its presence in the company of others justifies it, you know? Anita Loos, actually, when she first came out here, had a thrilling paragraph in which she said that there... in this creation of stars, this is the only way, she says, that people who used to be hotel maids can rise, really, in American culture, and suddenly the most unruly people, the most undisciplined, are being worshipped here, she writes back, probably to Robert Benchley. And it really is the case that simultaneously you have these worshipped people, but worship because they've been sanctioned in their amorality, not for having a principle or guided system of ethics, but for being able to violate it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But the system that needs to be violated, well, we keep changing those. I mean, so one minute they throw Ingrid Bergman out of the country for having a child out of wedlock, and then suddenly that becomes completely permissible, and then, I mean, we change the rules faster than we can break them.
It's funny, you know, they used to say that in order to write satire, one had to have a stable value system, But your satire, if it is that, seems to be based on the instability of the value system.
Well, I mean, Alice in Wonderland is basically that story of, and that was the first book that was read to me aloud and the first book that I learned to read aloud. And in Alice in Wonderland, nothing makes any sense and everything is backwards. And I think you better learn that from an early age or you won't make it.
I'm glad you said that, because that is the quality, the dizzy quality of having been at a mad tea party, that I like best about the male crossdresser support group. I especially love the man who flounces to the support group that he doesn't know what to wear to the grand librarian ball. It comes so out of nowhere, and it's such a pleasant thing to announce.
Thanks.
What are you working on now?
Well, I, as you might have been able to tell, I'm sort of staggering around myself at the moment. I began this tour last week for this book, and it's extremely important to me that I feel thrilled that they sent me out to meet people. And after all, we're living in a time when books are so disposable. I mean, a book is in the bookstore for 3 months before it's remaindered and sent back to the publisher. And a can of tuna fish in the supermarket doesn't go where those books go. And I feel that it took me 4 years to write the book, and I hope to find people that have my sense of humor out there. And for some reason, I've been invited to speak around the country, primarily at gay bookstores and Jewish community centers. But last week I was in Kentucky, where I read with Hunter S. Thompson for a benefit for the Kentucky Foundation for Literacy. And it's been quite a range of different stops and spots. And I was thrilled to read with Hunter S. Thompson, who does drink, and I would like to drink, but I can't drink very well, and I feel quite sick after 2 drinks. And he even got to have a bottle of Chivas brought out on stage while he was speaking. But somebody gave me a bottle of bourbon, and I couldn't carry it. So I put it, and I couldn't drink it either. So I put it back in my suitcase and thought, well, I'm going to go home and I'll have it there. I mean, not all at once, but over a period of time. Anyway, when I put it in the suitcase, and I got stuck at the airport for 12 hours, and I only had 1 day back in New York, and I arrived back in New York at 2:30 in the morning, and when I went to pick up my suitcase, boy, there was somebody near me who just reeked of alcohol. I couldn't believe anybody could drink that much. And when I picked up my suitcase, it was dripping, dripping. And then I realized I was the one who stank of liquor. It was my suitcase that the bottle of bourbon had broken in. And now the floor and the whole bag were just soaked in this alcohol. And of course, when I got back and I had 1 day in the city to recover, and everything had to be dry cleaned, and even so, the rest of my tour is going to be scented with bourbon.
Soused. I've been speaking to Tamma Janowitz, the author most recently of the Male Crossdresser Support Group. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer today is Scott Fritz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of ice and snow in books.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages, back to days of old when knights were bold and books.
Books, 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 books. Books. Books can be funny too.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's Book of the Mouse Pop Time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.